I think it's fairly safe to say that blood has always been sort of a powerful symbol, if nothing else, in not just in literature, but in our culture. I mean, they always talk about blood being thicker than water. Blood will out.
It's red.
It is red. You're caught red-handed.
Keeps you alive.
Lady Macbeth rubbing her hands feverishly, trying to get the scarlet spot off of her hands. There's a metaphorical power to blood, right? But now there is a real, tangible power to blood that perhaps may be surprising to people, and there's some ethical concerns associated with it.
You're talking about DNA, the genetic evidence that we carry on all of our sort of
right. It's one thing when your DNA is matched with your DNA in a sample of blood, right? But what's happening now is they're matching DNA because of your family's blood. Here's an example. Lonnie Franklin Jr., he's also known as the Grim Sleeper. He's accused of killing at least 10 people in California over a period of 25 years, perhaps many more. And it was the DNA evidence from his son's blood that led to his arrest.
How did that work?
The police used the state's familial search program. His son was arrested. They took his son's DNA sample, right, and then they compared it to the millions of DNA samples in the database, including the kids' family members.
And compared that to DNA evidence found at the scene of these crimes.
The Grim Sleeper crimes, and they came up with Lonnie Franklin.
Well, good for them.
Maybe.
Good for them.
Joining us now is Mitch Morrissey. He's the Denver District Attorney. Colorado and California are the only two states right now that have a codified policy that allows for these familial DNA searches. And also with us is George Annis. He's the Chair of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights at Boston University. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, Mitch, this case of the Grim Sleeper in California seems to me to be the perfect argument of the efficacy of familial DNA. I mean, this shows clearly the benefits to law enforcement in using this particular program. Do you agree?
I absolutely agree. Not only law enforcement, but to that community in Los Angeles, which is one of the poorer communities in the United States. And I think that it sent a strong message by law enforcement out there that they pay attention to these cases and they don't give up on them. This was a type of testing that was done under very strict controls out there in California, and they were able to get fantastic results.
All right, that's Mitch Morrissey. He's a Denver District Attorney, but also with us is George Annis. As I said, he works with bioethics. And George, do you also agree that this case of a serial killer in California is a good argument, a strong argument about the benefits of using familial DNA samples?
It's an exceptionally strong argument. You're not going to find a lot of sympathy for serial killers. And Mitch is absolutely right. The community can hopefully sleep a lot better knowing this person has been apprehended. So, yeah, these are the type of arguments that will drive this technology in law enforcement. And it will be very popular support.
And yet, the first time that they used DNA evidence was to catch a guy in Colorado in February of 2008 who was breaking into cars, and that called up, people did bring up ethics questions theirs. What made that controversial?
Well, breaking into cars, you know, murder is one thing. Breaking into cars is a trivial case for that. I mean, the guidelines that you want to use, I think, if you're going to do familial cases, is that it's an extremely serious crime, murder, you know, sexual predator, things like that. You've tried every other way you know to find this person, and you failed. And really, this is like your last chance.
Mitch, would you agree that that breaking into cars is a trivial use of familial DNA?
Well, let me tell you how that happened. It came up in a research project that we were doing. Our policy in Colorado is a lot like California's, a lot like the United Kingdom, is that you use it in these hard-to-solve cold cases where you have rapes and murders. But we were doing a research project, and we didn't want to ignore the fact that we actually solved that case. There were 60 cars broken into that night, and we prosecuted the individual for two of them. The victims of those certainly didn't think they were insignificant, but again, those wouldn't be the kind of cases that we would use this on, but it was part of our research project to show the rest of the world that this does in fact work.
Okay, again, that's Mitch Morrissey. He's the district attorney in Denver. George Annis of Boston University, I want to play for you this piece of tape from Pearl Wilson. This was included in PBS's Religion and Ethics News Weekly back in 2008. And she was very concerned that they were actually holding her son's DNA in this database even after he passed away.
My son lives in me and I in him. And his blood is my blood. and my blood was in him. I'm worried about them continuously holding my son's DNA in that database. I have not been in trouble a day in my life. They could come to my family members and even me. It is violating rights of innocent people.
George, do you think the fact that they hold it even after someone has passed away, does that complicate the ethical issue here?
I do. I mean, I think there should be limits on holding DNA profiles, but more important, there should be, I don't think anyone, any police department should be able to hold the DNA sample itself, the actual blood sample or saliva sample that the DNA was processed from to make the DNA profile. And in the United Kingdom, which was mentioned, they had to go before the European Court of Human Rights, which said that they have to put limits on how long they store blood, and they shouldn't be storing the samples at all. They should destroy the sample as soon as they've done a DNA profile. And certainly, I think, although, you know, obviously with big families, that DNA can always be useful, but at death, it seems to me that that's a pretty good point, even to destroy the profile of the person who's been convicted. And it shouldn't be stored at all if the person hasn't been convicted, I don't believe.
Mitch Morrissey of the District Attorney's Office in Denver, what's your response to that? Are we holding on to DNA profiles and samples for too long?
Well, you know, that's really a different issue as far as familial searching is concerned. But let me tell you, I run one of the most aggressive cold case programs in the United States. And we have gotten a number of hits to individuals that have passed away, serving sentences in the penitentiary. We've had victims that have passed away and not been able to proceed with the cases. I think it's an important answer to a victim to go and tell her that the man that raped you or the man that raped and murdered your daughter, we identified him and he died and he's dead. And so there have been a number of CODIS hits and cold case hits to individuals in the database that have passed away, and that helps you resolve the case and give closure to the victims.
Mitch Morrissey is the Denver District Attorney, and George Annis is the Chair of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights at Boston University. I'm interested in hearing your take on this also. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE. What do you think? Do the benefits to law enforcement, to the pursuit of justice, does that outweigh any ethical concerns? Let us know.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.